Welcome everyone to today's Weber Training Teleclass, which is the first of the year. Teleclass Organising Group have put together an exciting programme for 2008, and you'll be able to see details of that on the last slide of this presentation. As we're all aware in the UK, outbreaks of Clostridium difficile have been really high profile in both healthcare publications as well as in the general media. And it's with great pleasure that today I'm going to introduce the speaker to guide us through this issue. Christine Perry qualified as a registered nurse back in 1982. After working in various hospitals and community settings, she moved into infection control as a speciality in 1994 and soon became a nurse consultant in infection control at the United Bristol Healthcare Trust. She's a former chair of the UK Infection Control Nurses Association, which is now known as the Infection Prevention Society, and is currently working for both the Department of Health and the South West Strategic Health Authority, leading on programs to reduce healthcare-associated infections. And her particular interests lie in MRSA and Clostridium difficile. So I'd warmly like to welcome you, Chris, to take over the reins for the next hour and tell us about your experience being involved in the Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells outbreak.
Thank you very much, Maria. While we're on the first slide, I would perhaps like to point out to people that having been involved in the reports and all the investigation that went on at Maidstone Tunbridge Wells, I inevitably have information available to me from reading lots of interview transcripts and sitting in on lots of interviews and seeing lots of documents that have not been published in the report itself. So some questions that you ask, I may have to not answer because I have to be sure that I obviously only give information that has been made public available from the report. So I hope people will understand that. And if we move on to the next slide, I think it's important to set the scene, really, in terms of the trust, Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells. And for people that don't know England very well, it is down in the southeast of the country in the Garden of England, Kent. And the trust is made up of a merger of two previous trusts that happened in the year 2000. And it covers an estimated 500,000 population, employs 5,000 staff, and as with many trusts in England, the bed base can change, and at the time of the investigation, it varied between 857 and 900 beds. There are three hospital sites that make up the trust. One of them is Pembrey Hospital, which has 136 beds, and predominantly is women's and children's services now. Kent and Sussex Hospital, and that's the one to the, as you're looking at the slide, to the bottom right, which has 284 beds and is made up of a variety of different buildings that have been built at different times throughout the last century or so. And Maidstone Hospital, which is the one top right as you're looking at the slide, which is 437 beds. I'm not sure about the time that this was built, but it's a nucleus type of hospital, so it was probably built around about the 1980s. I think what's interesting to note in a number of trusts around England and various rural parts of the country as well, that although the hospitals, the two main hospitals, Kent and Sussex and Maidstone Hospital, are only 18 miles apart, travelling between the two sites can be quite difficult. It usually took us about 30 to 45 minutes when we're in a taxi travelling between them. So I think it makes organisations of these hospitals quite difficult to achieve. This is a trust that does have quite a difficult background, and they were investigated in 2003 over outpatient waiting times, where there was a suggestion that they'd been deliberately misrepresented to make it look better towards achievement of targets. And at that time, the Tinston report noted that this was a trust under extreme pressure, individuals are under extreme pressure, there was a culture that failure was unacceptable, and there was a perceived lack of support for people. So even as far back as 2003, this was recognised as a trust that was particularly having some difficulties. Move on to the next slide. Why was there a healthcare commission investigation at Maidstone and Tenby trials. Well, this one was at the request of the Strategic Health Authority. And there was a number of reasons why the Strategic Health Authority asked the Healthcare Commission to go in and have a look. First of all, there seemed to be little or no recognition of any rise in cases that had happened between October and December 2005. And on a slide later on, you will be able to see the actual figures month by month for the organisation. There was consistent data that had been supplied by the Trust in terms of cases and mortality, and this did not seem to correlate with the information that was being provided in terms of national reporting into the Health Protection Agency. And historically, the Trust had had high background rates of Clostridium difficile infection. There was also a considerable amount of public concern around cleanliness, control of infection, and standards of nursing care. If you move on to the next slide, there was an undercover investigation by a BBC reporter in 2004, where she worked undercover as a cleaner in the emergency department, mainly at Tunbridge Wells Hospital, I believe. And her report found overflowing bins, blood-stained gowns had been left on trolleys. And Professor Hugh Pennington, when asked to comment on the content of the report, said that he saw inexcusable practices and it was the worst hospital that he'd ever seen. And all this went to fuel public concerns about cleanliness. If you move on to the next slide, again you'll see this is BBC News from 2006. And at this point in time, there was a huge amount of public concern again around cleanliness at Maidstone Hospital in particular now, where a number of patients had died from Clostridium difficile. So all this added up to concerns for the Strategic Health Authority as to what was happening at the Trust in relation to infection control. If you move on to the next slide, this is just to explain for people not in England the work of the Healthcare Commission. The Healthcare Commission applies to NHS and independent services in England only. It's independent from the Department of Health and from the National Health Service, and they're there to make sure there are improvements and quality in healthcare that's provided by both the NHS and by the independent sector. It has a role in producing annual ratings for NHS trusts and undertaking an annual assessment. It carries out reviews of specific areas, and it has carried out an improvement review around healthcare-associated infection that was published last year. It also carries out investigations where there are serious failings within NHS organisations. If we move on to the next slide, the particular terms of reference for the investigation at Maidstone Tunbridge Wells were to look at arrangements for identification and notification of cases and outbreaks of Clostridium difficile, to examine any factors contributing to rates of Clostridium difficile and to the outbreaks. The investigations do go wider than just infection control, and our terms of reference were to look at arrangements at ward level for patient safety and quality of care, and the general governance arrangements, and also the priority that infection control was given by both the Trust, the Primary Care Trust, and the Strategic Health Authority, and in particular to look at the role of the Health Protection Agency. If you move on to the next slide, I think it's important to note how these investigations are carried out and who's involved in them. There is always a lead for the investigation, and the lead for this one was the same lady that led the Stoke Mandeville investigation into Clostridium difficile, and it's Dr. Heather Wood. And there's a rather large team of Healthcare Commission staff and external advisors that support these investigations. If you look on the document, the report from the investigation, you'll see there's 8 names listed from the Healthcare Commission staff. And that ranges from analytical staff to legal advisors. However, throughout the investigation, I had contact with certainly more than 8 Healthcare Commission staff in terms of the background work that goes on with these investigations and the analysis of documents, etc. We had a chief executive officer from NHS Trust in England, Dr. Frank Harsant, Professor of Nursing, Professor Pauline Fielding. I was the infection control nurse specialist on there. We had a microbiologist, infection control doctor, Dr. Louise Tier from Essex, and an epidemiologist who also happens to be a general practitioner, Dr. Lance Saker. So it's made up of people who have expertise in terms of investigation, and then a team of clinically relevant experts to the investigation. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see that there were over 200 interviews undertaken between October 2006 and April 2007, and this was the time that the team were on-site and off-site doing the investigation. 1,000-plus documents were reviewed for this investigation, and the documents would range from incident reports, trust board reports, infection control committee minutes, notes of infection control team meetings, clinical governance reports, ward-based staffing reports. A whole variety of documents are reviewed to give the background information. For this investigation, we also reviewed 50 sets of notes, and I'll talk a little bit more about the methodology for that later. And we carried out a number of scheduled and an announced site visit. And following the investigation finishing on site April 2007, the report was published in November 2007. And I'm sure you're all aware, are able to download it from the Healthcare Commission website if you wish to read it in more detail. Next slide. Moving on now to the findings related to surveillance. In terms of national surveillance, Maidstone Tunbridge Wells Trust had the 12th highest rate of Clostridium difficile in the over 65 years between January to September 2006. And that's out of 166 acute trusts in England. In April 2006 to March 2007, they also had the 41st highest MRSA bacteremia rate per 1,000 bed days. From typing that had been carried out in a number of, in two different laboratories, during March 2006, 7 out of 10 C. diff isolates that were sent to the laboratory were found to be of type 07. This is the same, thought to be the same strain as the NAP1 that's described in other parts of the world. And in April 2006, from another laboratory, 6 out of 8 specimens of Clostridium difficile were found to be type 027. So it was clear that the trust did have background levels of type 07 within the hospital. On to the next slide, what was happening with their local surveillance? Well, from 2000, the Trust had set up a very crude local Clostridium difficile database. This was based on paper records. So a paper record would come to the infection control nurse. It would then be entered into a local database. And when looking at the database, it showed that there was incomplete data. It only included date of admission and names of patients. It had little detail on specimen dates and any outcomes in relation to the Clostridium difficile positive report. It was also very reliant on the lead infection control nurse. She entered the data, and then it went away for analysis, and it could take anything for 2 to 3 months for that analysis to be completed and for it to then be reported to the Infection Control Committee. The Infection Control Committee met quarterly, and this was a forum in which the Clostridium difficile data was reported. So therefore, by the time the Infection Control Committee met, and with the retrospective nature of the data, it was usually 3 to 4 months out of date. As it was heavily reliant on the lead infection control nurse to enter the data, while she was off sick and then retired, the data was not being analysed locally, which probably led to a lack of recognition of increase in cases promptly. The Trust did invest in an electronic surveillance package, but this was purchased in 2005, and it wasn't until a year later that this surveillance package was started to be used for Clostridium difficile and other surveillance. Moving on to the next slide, you can see the numbers of cases for Maidstone Hospital, the top line, Kent and Sussex Hospital, the light blue line, the next line down, and Pembrey Hospital, the line at the bottom there. From April 04 to the 30th of September 2006, Maidstone Hospital had a total of 738 cases, Kent and Sussex Hospital 353 cases, Pembrey Hospital 85 cases, and what this equated to was average new cases of 39.2 per month, 24.6 of which were at Maidstone Hospital. Now, the Healthcare Commission have labelled the period April 2006 to September 2006 as the outbreak time in their report, and they chose this as it was formally reported in April as an outbreak to the Health Protection Unit and to the Strategic Health Authority. But looking at the data, it's clear that there was a peak of cases that was seen at Maidstone Hospital October 05, November 05, December 05, and this continued, although dropped slightly in January, increased again in March 06, and the increase as well at Kent and Sussex Hospital that started in January 2006. Moving on to the next slide, information on deaths. The Trust asked for an initial review in April 2006 of the deaths due to Clostridium difficile. This initial review was done by the medical director along with a consultant microbiologist, and what the Healthcare Commission found when they looked at this review that there was a lack of clarity over the purpose. Both reviewers worked separately. There is no clarity over the number of cases that were reviewed. Both reviewers said that it was less than 15, but it's not clear whether it was the same cases that were reviewed by both of the reviewers or different cases. The consultant microbiologist used the Stoke-Mandeville classification for death. The medical director looked at consistency over whether death due to Clostridium difficile was on the death certificate. And following this review, there was no formal report available within the Trust or presented to the Board or the Infection Control Committee. A further review was undertaken by a consultant intensivist at the request of the Trust. And this one purported to review all patients who died in the hospital and had been confirmed to be Clostridium difficile positive. However, again, the methodology for carrying out this review was not clear. It was not comprehensive. And from the summary of the Healthcare Commission, only 49% of patients with Clostridium difficile on their death certificates were included in this summary. Some of the reasons for this, one of them was due to lack of notes being available to be reviewed. And again, the results of this were not presented to the management board or to the executive team. There was inconsistency around information on number of deaths that were reported by the Trust in press reports and those that were reported to the Health Protection Unit. And in a press release that was released in 2006 and a presentation to the local scrutiny committee, the Trust were attributing the increase in cases to patients coming in from the outside of hospital rather than to cases inside the hospital, whereas the Healthcare Commission found that only 10% of patients at this time were likely to have Clostridium difficile from another source rather than from the hospital. Moving on to the next slide. This is where the investigation at Maidstone Tambridge Trial differed quite significantly to the investigation at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, in that there was an extensive review of notes and quality of care. And we reviewed 50 out of 274 sets of notes. And the 274 cases were anybody who was Clostridium difficile positive and who who died in hospital between April 2004 and June 2006. And the cases that were chosen were deliberately weighted under their classification of diseases. So we excluded cases where their admission to hospital was likely to lead to death. For example, patients who had terminal illnesses. The areas of scrutiny that we looked at were antibiotic prescribing, whether the clinical staff were recognising severe disease and managing deteriorating patients, fluid management, nutrition management, and the management and treatment of Clostridium difficile infection. We also looked at whether Clostridium difficile was likely to have caused or contributed to death. The two reviewers worked independently. There were four clinical reviewers altogether, and we worked in teams where notes were reviewed by two people independently and then discussed and agreed on areas of concern and the cause of death, whether that was likely, definite, possibly, probably, unlikely or not to have contributed, Clostridium difficile being the primary cause or the contributory cause. On the next slide, what did we find related to general management? In terms of documentation, in five cases, there was no mention of Clostridium difficile infection diagnosis anywhere in the patient's record. For a third of them, there was no evidence that they'd been regularly reviewed by medical staff, and stool charts were only present in less than 15% of the 50 cases that we reviewed. And where they were present, there was no standard description. The Bristol stool scale was not regularly being used at the Trust at that point in time. And in 22 of the 50 cases, there was no documented evidence of involvement with the microbiologist and the infection control team. That's not to say it didn't happen. That's to say that we could find no documentary evidence that there had been any discussion or input from the infection control and microbiology teams. Moving on to the next slide, there were concerns around the timeliness of obtaining samples. 17 of the 50 cases were tested 3 or more days after symptoms of diarrhea were evident. The delay in treatment and diagnosis was usually because of delay in the specimen being sent to the laboratory rather than delay in processing in the laboratory. There was also concerns around timeliness of antibiotic treatment. 5 patients were not started on appropriate antibiotic treatment for 3 or more days after a positive result was obtained, despite them still being symptomatic. And in some cases, there was a delay in specimens being sent when patients had previously been tested and were found to be negative at Clostridium difficile, but continued to have diarrhea. There was considerable delays in people sending subsequent specimens to the laboratory that then came up as Clostridium difficile positive. And in 12 cases, we found a delay of over 1 week from a recognition of symptoms to treatment for Clostridium difficile. Moving on to the next slide, antibiotic management. We found cause for concern in 42% of the cases that we reviewed. There was excessive use of broad-spectrum antibiotics and also excessive use often in an additive manner. So the patient would be prescribed one antibiotic. If they were not resolving with their signs and symptoms of infection, then they would be prescribed an additional antibiotic rather than complete review of the antibiotics. They were used with little evidence of need. For example, they were used where a wound was oozing or where a patient had mild fever without actual signs and symptoms of definite infection. And they were used for excessive time periods. 2 examples that are given in the report was antibiotics given for 23 days for a urinary tract infection and 17 days for a chest infection. And there was evidence of continued use in patients with ongoing symptoms of Clostridium difficile diarrhea. There was also concern around prescription of antibiotics to treat Clostridium difficile. For 25 patients where diarrhea persisted for more than 7 days, metronidazole was continued to be prescribed where the reviewers felt that they should have considered changing the prescription to vancomycin. There was also concern around missing doses where patients were nil by mouth and there hasn't been consideration to prescribe intravenous metronidazole, or where there are missed doses for no apparent reason on the drug chart. On the next slide, it shows some of the concerns that we had around clinical management of the patients. For fluid management, 36% of the cases reviewed gave us cause for concern, and this was around completion of fluid charts and assessment of patients' fluid balance, and also taking the appropriate blood test in terms of urea and electrolyte and acting on outcomes. Nutritional management gave cause for concern in 34% of cases reviewed, and this was around adequate assessment of patients' nutritional status and failing to act on evidence of decline in nutritional status from blood results, and also on dietitian's referral where assessment had shown a need for a referral. We also had concerns around recognition of severe disease. This was both in terms of monitoring the disease and acting on deterioration. And one of the real concerns that all the clinical reviewers have was whether clinical staff really saw Clostridium difficile as a diagnosis in its own right and as potentially being responsible for the signs and symptoms that they were seeing in their patients. There was a general concern that medical staff would be looking for other causes of deterioration and not considering that Clostridium difficile could be causing severe disease in these patients. In terms of estimation of cause of death, the reviewers again looked at this independently and then discussed and agreed on the outcomes. And from our discussions, we felt that Clostridium difficile was the main cause of death in 3 of the 50 cases, definitely, and probably in 10 of the 50 cases. Contribution to death, we thought it definitely contributed in 42% of the cases, probably in 36%, and again, possibly in 18%. It's estimated from the 50 cases that we reviewed that of the 345 cases, that Clostridium difficile would probably be the main cause of death in up to 90 cases. This figure is close to the mortality rate of 6.9% that's been cited from the New England Journal of Medicine in 2005. So our estimation is probably a true reflection of death rates that have been found in other investigations and research around the world. I think it's important that the family's experience is taken into account, and you'll see from the next slide what the family reported to the Healthcare Commission. They reported difficulty in seeing senior medical staff. They felt they were given inadequate explanations around Clostridium difficile, and in particular around the possible prognosis from this and the severity of the disease. The families felt that they'd been led to believe that this was just a hospital infection, and they were quite surprised in some cases where their relatives died with Clostridium difficile. Other areas they were concerned about was the advice given to them around precautions they should take when visiting and around soiled clothing. And they generally felt that Clostridium difficile was not being taken seriously enough or not relayed to them seriously enough in terms of the condition. The family reported experiences as well around nursing care. They felt that there was lack of response to call bells. There were delays that were reported by a number of cases, number of relatives. They had concerns around skin care and bed sores, infection control precautions, and the privacy and dignity afforded to these patients. On the next slide, contributing factors, I've included antibiotics again. And as we found in the notes review, there was broad-spectrum antibiotic prescription across the board at the Trust. And the original policy for the Trust, antibiotic policy, included a number of broad-spectrum antibiotics. In 2005, the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Nursing Officer for England wrote to all organisations reminding them of the Clostridium difficile guidance and asking all organisations to review their antibiotic policy This was not done at Maidstone Tunbridge Wells. Until the intervention of the Health Protection Unit at an outbreak meeting in April 2006, there was some tension between the Health Protection Unit and the medical microbiologist at the Trust over whether the antibiotic policy needed to be reviewed. The microbiologist wanted to concentrate on cleanliness and isolation, and the Health Protection Unit thought it was important that antibiotic prescribing was addressed. There was some action taken, but the Health Protection Unit remained concerned about this, and in June 2006 they wrote to the Trust again, and it's following this letter that banned antibiotics were removed from the ward and broad-spectrum prescribing was reduced. And as I previously reported, the Healthcare Commission felt that the inappropriate prescribing that was found in the notes review contributed to the outbreak that happened at the Trust. Moving on to the next slide, other contributory factors were around lack of side rooms, particularly at Kent and Sussex Hospital, being an older build. And on a number of the wards I visited, the location of the single rooms were, as you expect to see on some old Nightingale wards, were at the entrance to the ward rather than being in the location of the wards. And with patients with Clostridium difficile being relatively unwell, it was difficult for them to use these single rooms for isolation of patients. The isolation facilities at Maidstone Hospital were relatively better, but were still limited. Hand-washing facilities were also an issue, particularly, again, in the Nightingale type of wards at Kent and Sussex Hospital. And from the ward visits that we did, 20 out of 29 ward visits, we found hand wash basins obstructed or difficult to reach. Sluice space and storage, particularly at Kent and Sussex, was at an absolute premium, and the sluices were very small in terms of being able to store commodes and being able to clean commodes. And bed spacing was an issue. And you'll see the picture of the bed spacing on one of the wards at Kent and Sussex Hospital, where the beds were so close together that patients could literally reach out and touch each other without having to lean over the side of the bed. On the next slide, cleanliness and hygiene. Cleaning hours have been raised as an issue within the Trust. At Maidstone Hospital, cleaning was only available 7:30 till midday initially, and there was no cleaning service out of hours, so nurses had to clean the beds between patients. There were concerns over general standards of cleanliness, and in the 2006 annual patient survey, the Trust was in the worst 20% for cleanliness of the ward toilets and washing facilities. And if you move on to the next slide with the picture on, you will see the dirty shower on Ward 14A at Kent and Sussex Hospital that was taken on the 13th of December 2006. This is just one photographic example of the cleanliness of the environment that we found on our ward visits. Moving on to the next slide, commodes were also raised as an issue by the Healthcare Commission team. But this had also been raised previously by the Trust themselves. In a 2004 audit by the Infection Control Team, 40% of areas were partially compliant with cleanliness to the underside of their commodes. And in an audit that was carried out in 2006, 98% of the commodes that were audited were soiled. And half of the staff that were asked at audits reported using alcohol wipes to clean commodes. And if you move on to the next slide, again, you can see the base of a commode from the accident and emergency department at Maidstone Hospital that was taken in November 2006. Moving on to the next slide, there were concerns around use of treatment and clinical rooms for activities other than drawing up drugs and clean preparation of equipment. Seven wards that we visited had clean utility rooms that were being used to make drinks and snacks. And if you move on to the next slide, you can see the sink in Culpeper Ward, Maidstone Hospital, that was taken on the 3rd of January 2007. And you can see the cups and the milk jug in a very, very dirty sink. What you can't see from that slide was to the left-hand side of this, on the clean treatment preparation area, was also a microwave and food preparation area, as well as being the clinical room for drawing up of drugs for patients. Moving on to the next slide, linen storage was identified as an issue for a number of wards. And moving on to the picture on the next slide, again, you can see clean linen that's being stored on open shelving on Mercer Ward, Maidstone Hospital. And again, this was noted not just on one ward in the hospital, but on more than one ward around the trust. Moving on to the next slide, the infection control team. The accountability for the infection control team was less than clear. Professionally, the team were accountable to the director of nursing. The pathology manager held the infection control budget. The clinical director of pathology was not aware of any responsibility that they had, and the director of operations potentially had some responsibility for the team, but again, this role was not clear. So the team had no clarity around who they should be going to in terms of raising issues or who had direct responsibility for them. In terms of microbiologist time and activity, there were no specific sessions originally allocated to them related to infection control. And in the time they had available, they were rarely able to be doing ward visits. Most of their activity related to infection control was in meetings with the infection control nurses and providing advice by telephone. Infection control nurse staffing during sickness and vacancies was an issue. As I previously noted, the senior infection control nurse went on sick leave and then retired. And during that time, there was no consideration as to whether a locum infection control nurse should be appointed. For the size of the trust, there were two whole-time equivalent infection control nurses, one based on the Maidstone site, one based on the Kent and Sussex site, who would then have to cover for each other in periods of annual leave. The infection control committee was poorly attended. It was mainly the infection control team that attended, with very little representation from the directorates. And the infection control audits that were carried out when the team had time to do this, the audit loop was not being closed because there were no structures to follow up on any recommendations that were made by the team. The infection control team were not working very well together. They were working on two different sites. The microbiologists met infrequently, and the infection control nurses had little time to really work together on these issues. There was conflicting advice that was being given by the microbiologist in terms of practices, and this led to different practice being instituted at the two different hospitals. And whilst they had a linkness scheme, this was not well established, and the infection control team were working reactively and had very limited time to be able to support a linkness system. Moving on to the next slide, policy and practice. 30 of the 31 infection control policies had gone past their review date. In terms of fitness for purpose, the trust acknowledged themselves that their outbreak control policy was no longer fit for purpose and did not reflect current issues and practice. And there were issues around accessibility. All policies in the trust had been moved to the intranet, but not all wards had computers and not everybody had access to be able to look at these policies on the intranet. The policies, when they were there, were often contradictory to the advice that was being given, for example, around whether patients could be barrier nursed on the ward and guidance for cohort nursing, and they lacked specific detail to inform staff. In terms of training for infection control, there was induction training, but this was not attended by all staff. And between September 2005 and August 2006, only 51% of clinical staff had attended infection control update training. Moving on to the next slide, which is around patient isolation. There was confusion amongst staff over what they should be doing when isolating patients. And you will see from the various photographs that there was a variety of signs that were being used to indicate patients were in isolation. They were also using trolleys at the end of the bed as an indication to staff and to patients that patients were being barrier nursed. They were attempting to bury a nurse patient in bays with tight bed spacing, as you've seen on the picture with the two bed spaces at Kent and Sussex. A cohort ward was opened at Maidstone Hospital, but with no real discussion over which ward it should be. And other patients were admitted to bays on the Clostridium difficile cohort ward, and there is evidence that cross-infection happened to non-C. diff patients in clean, in inverted comma, bays, whilst the cohort ward was on Watman ward. Moving on to the next slide, nursing staffing. 90% of the medical and surgical wards at the Trust fell below the national average staffing for ward type and for size. In the National Patient Survey as well, they came out as being in the worst 20% of trusts for staffing levels. These were being reported in incident forms between June 04 and 06, 485 incident forms, and a report of a complaint that has gone as far as the Ombudsman in 2005. The recommendations from the Ombudsman was the Trust needed to consider risk of low staffing levels and skill mix. Also in interviews, more than 90% of people commented that the wards had too few nurses. This was not just from nursing staff. This was from managerial staff, medical staff, and cleaning support staff. And nurses themselves reported that they were going home upset because they felt they could not do their job well. And a Trust own audit in November 2004, they found that 49% of patients who needed additional monitoring had no fluid charts completed, which again was suggestive of lack of time to do this. And the Trust was in the worst 20% for staff reporting high levels of stress in 2004 and 2005. So there's no doubt the nurse staffing was lower than it required to be, and this was putting a considerable amount of pressure on nurses who were trying to care for very poorly patients with very low nurse staffing levels. On the next slide, issues around the Director of Infection Prevention and Control. This is a role that is unique to England, and the role of the Director of Infection Prevention and Control, there is one designated within an NHS organisation. They're responsible for overseeing control of infection control policies and implementation. They're responsible for the infection control team. They report directly to the Trust Board. They have the authority to challenge inappropriate hygiene practice and antibiotic prescribing. They are to assess the impact of policies and plans and make recommendations for change. And they are an integral member of the organisation's clinical governance and patient safety team and structures. So the idea behind the Director of Infection Prevention and Control is this is a senior level appointment who is acting really as an advocate and a champion at a very senior level for infection control. The Director of Infection Prevention and Control at Maidstone Tunbridge Wells was the Director of Nursing. It was unclear how that appointment was made. It was not taken directly to Trust Board. There was no evidence in any Trust Board minutes of when the appointment was made and how the appointment was made. The Director of Nursing had a very full portfolio they were working to, and infection control was added on to an already full portfolio. Although the Director of Infection Prevention and Control had a good working relationship with the infection control nurses, this was poorer with the microbiologists, and there were no documented direct meetings with the microbiologists. Most of the communications was carried out through the infection control nurses. The annual reports prepared by the DIPSI did not include any comparative data, and the Trust Board had no idea that Maidstone Tunbridge Wells had relatively high rates of infection. And the report is critical of the DIPSI in not ensuring that the Trust had the appropriate structures in place for identification of outbreaks and for establishment of cohort wards. Moving on to the next slide, at strategic level, the Healthcare Commission found that the board was poorly involved in the healthcare associated infection agenda, probably because of poor information and because there was no active discussion of infection control issues at a board level. reporting mechanisms were through the Infection Control Committee and then through governance systems. So again, the information that was reported was relatively out of date. The assurance framework and risk register that the Trust were using was poorly understood by staff, so was not actively used in terms of improving practice around risk management and infection control in particular. And with the standards for better health, the hygiene code, which became law in England in October 2006, for trusts to comply to the elements of the hygiene code, it was not until March 2007 that the Trust Board in Maidstone Tunbridge Wells received a report on compliance to the hygiene code and a gap analysis. There was also issues around reporting of incidents at a strategic level. Of 64 serious untoward incidents since April 2003, there were only three where there was evidence of a proper investigation and a report. And staff in the Trust had little confidence that the clinical incident reporting system led to any actual learning within the organisation. So that's the main findings from the report. What are the lessons that we have to learn from Maidstone Tunbridge Wells? So moving on to the next slide, there are key lessons to learn around antibiotic prescribing, in that they should always be indicated and that indication should be documented in the patient's record. They should be targeted to the specific infection that we are aiming to treat, and that there should always be a stop review date, and that they should be reviewed and acted on after that date. It's clear that there's a need for more junior doctor training around antibiotic prescribing in terms of the three things that I've just mentioned. It's clear as well that the NHS needs to learn that Clostridium difficile is a condition that needs to be managed appropriately. And again, I think the report has done much in highlighting to people the importance that Clostridium difficile is not just a result of coming into hospital. It's a condition and a diagnosis in its own right that needs its own clinical review and its own clinical management. And the Trust are now using a care pathway to improve the management of patients with Clostridium difficile. Patients with Clostridium difficile have got to be monitored appropriately in terms of both how their disease is progressing, their nutritional status, their hydration status, and their general management. And the care of these patients has to be of a high standard. And there's lessons for the NHS in terms of managing cleanliness and hygiene and monitoring and acting on issues related to cleanliness across any organisation. Moving on to the next slide, as I've mentioned, there was an investigation into Clostridium difficile at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, Buckinghamshire NHS Trust previously, and I was also part of that investigation team. And there are findings that are similar in the Maidstone report that there are to Stoke Mandeville. Both of the trusts had undergone mergers, and these have been difficult mergers that were leading to reconfiguration of services, hot sites, cold sites, movement of services around between the two sites. Both trusts had been in financial difficulties and had been under a considerable amount of pressure to pull that round. Both trusts were also in the process of a private finance initiative to provide new hospital sites for them. Both of them suffered from poor environments and from lack of single rooms. So again, messages to the NHS and lessons to be learned is for organisations that currently have any of these issues going on, then they have to be sure that their activity is not putting patients at risk of infection. Moving on to the next slide, I think there are a number of questions that anybody providing services, not just NHS providers, but anybody that's providing services to patients have to ask themselves. Do they have a good DIPSI? Is the role of the DIPSI formalised? And is the DIPSI competent to do the job? do they have a robust system for surveillance? Does that system include regular reporting, i.e. monthly? Does it include trend analysis? And does it also include analysis of rates against other organisations? Do the board discuss infection prevention and control? And are they monitoring the appropriate indicators for healthcare-associated infection? Does the trust monitor and report deaths due to healthcare-associated infection? And are they carrying out appropriate root cause analysis processes related to incidents and deaths due to HCAI? What are the trust isolation policies and practice, and are those being complied with? Does the trust have appropriate escalation policies? I didn't have time to discuss this in detail, but during the investigation, we found that there were escalation areas being opened that were not adequately staffed and did not have the adequate facilities to care for patients. How is the trust monitoring their cleanliness, and how are they acting on this? And I think particularly important, the last 2 points, how, as an organisation, are you managing and reviewing your patients with Clostridium difficile, and how are you ensuring that antibiotic prescribing is of the highest standard, and how are you monitoring that your antibiotic prescribing is of the highest standard? Moving on to the next page, within the NHS, we have the role of providers and we have the role of commissioners. We're primary care organisations. We're commission services from NHS and from independent providers. And it's important for anybody who is commissioning these services to be asking themselves these questions. Do they get appropriate surveillance reports from their providers? Are they doing appropriate quality monitoring? Do they have the right processes in place and outcomes? Do they have agreements for how outbreaks will be reported to them from their provider organisations? And how robust are their commissioning agreements for infection prevention and control? And again, I didn't have time to go into detail, but the review did look at the role of the Health Protection Agency and some clarity around what primary care trusts are expecting from the Health Protection Agency in terms of monitoring and acting and supporting them in relation to healthcare-associated infection. That's my last slide, but I would just like to give some personal reflections, if I can, in the last couple of minutes from having now been involved in a couple of investigations. I've always been fairly hot on documentation, but I will now be even hotter when I go back to be working as an infection control nurse in my documentation, because the Healthcare Commission will ask specific questions around why did you make a decision on that day. For example, if I'd have made a decision to close a cohort ward and put patients back into single rooms, they would ask me specific questions around how I came to arrive at that decision to close that ward. The other thing that I reflect on is around the Director of Infection Prevention and Control role, and it's vital that this role is integrated into the infection control team. There's regular communication between them, regular meetings, and that the DIPSI can see the day-to-day activities and what is happening within an organisation. From doing the case notes review, I can see that as a very, very powerful learning tool for infection control teams to use to get the message across to medical and nursing staff around the importance of healthcare-associated infection. Reading through case notes, you could visibly see patients getting Clostridium difficile and deteriorating, and it really painted a picture of how these patients were being managed. And I would urge infection control teams to use case studies in all your presentations to really get that message across. And the final thing is that it does not stop at the report. The Healthcare Commission went in and did a follow-up visit to Maidstone Tunbridge Wells on the 12th and 13th of December. And from that, they found there have been encouraging signs of improvement and that infection control is obviously now a high priority and Clostridium difficile is being recognised as a serious diagnosis in its own right. And they have also recently just undertaken an unannounced visit. So the report coming out in November is not the end. It's still moving things forward. And as I've said, from the follow-up visit on the 12th to 13th of December, it's really encouraging to see that a difference has been made to patients. Thank you.
Wow, thank you very much for that, Chris. I think there's some pretty sobering things for us all to take away and reflect on in clinical practice there. I'm sure all of you will agree it's been a very thought-provoking presentation, and I think all of us can take something away to challenge our practice and to challenge our colleagues' practice. I think one of the things that struck me is how the complexity of preventing infection has demonstrated very profoundly in what you said. So many things affect whether or not patients get infections, don't they? The whole thing has to be looked at. Whole things have to be considered.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole systems approach. Definitely.
Exactly. So thank you very, very much for that, Chris. Can I just ask people to move on to the next slide, which informs you of the British Teleclass series for the rest of the year. And because we feel Clostridium difficile is such an important issue in healthcare at the moment, you'll see that in September we've got another session on it, and Dr. Mark Wilcox, who's known as an international specialist in the field, is going to talk to us about C. diff, prevention better than cure. Obviously, it's better than cure. We can see when things go wrong what happens, and Mark's going to talk to us about managing patients to avoid the risk, reduce the risk of them getting Clostridium difficile and the consequences of that. So I'd just like to thank all of you for tuning in today, and particularly thanking Chris for an excellent presentation that has really challenged us all, I'm sure. Thank you very much.